If you have ever wondered how tense the life of Christ must have been at times, here is a comment from the middle of Luke's gospel, which can give you a good idea. One Sabbath, when he went to dine at the house of a ruler who belonged to the Pharisees, they were watching him. Luke doesn't tell us who they are, but I think we all know. The word stands for those who have decided to do you in, but who are waiting to be sure it's safe, who need a little more evidence before they show their true colors. So they tap your telephone, try to catch you in some verbal trap, steam open your business mail, waiting until they can get you at the least possible cost to themselves. On this particular day, they had come to the dinner party, correctly dressed and full of smiles, ready to catch Jesus in some technical violation of the Sabbath. He had a reputation already for being a little careless. If he slips now in front of the mayor, maybe they can get it on the nightly news and ruin him with the common people who seem to like him so much. And it shouldn't be too hard to catch him, given the nitpicking nature of the Sabbath laws. If a woman combed her hair on Saturday, it could be taken as a form of labor, which violated the day of rest. If a man passing through a field of barley took some of the heads and rubbed them in his hands to get grain for a light lunch, that could be called a harvest and therefore forbidden by the Sabbath laws. You had to be a legal expert just to get through the day. So they are watching, whispering to those who haven't heard it yet, how this man had eaten the other day in the house of another Pharisee and had failed to wash his hands before dinner. They're not talking about a quick rinse with Dial and warm water for reasons of personal hygiene, but about a religious ceremony which he disregarded at times because he felt it was a matter of choice and had very little to do with a person's character. Maybe now, if they are lucky, he will make another gaffe and discredit himself so much that people will stop paying attention to him and he will have to go back home to Galilee and to the woodworking shop. It isn't long before they get the chance they've been waiting for. A man shows up at the party in need of healing. Or, who knows, maybe they bribed him to come so that they could use him as a test for the young rabbi. Anyway, on purpose or by accident, suddenly the trap is baited. It is illegal to heal someone on the Sabbath because healing is a form of work, and all work is forbidden. So what will Jesus do, since he is a healer and here is a patient? He knows, of course, what they are thinking. Their eyes give them away. He decides to take the offensive. Is it lawful or not? He asked them to heal on the Sabbath. These men are all research scholars, members of the bar. The question is absurdly easy to answer. They know it, as they know the answers to all such questions. They can quote instantly from their scripture, section 3, paragraph B, and settle it. There isn't even any ambiguity about this one, at least not as far as their traditions are concerned. The answer is no, it is not lawful to heal on the Sabbath. And yet, for some reason, no one gives that answer. The room is silent. I think we know why. If they say it would be okay to heal, that, yes, human need would surely take precedence in this case, they violate the letter of their own law, and they will soon be quarreling among themselves. If they say no, with that poor sick man standing right in front of them, they put legalism above mercy and make themselves look heartless. And all of a sudden, for us, as it so often happens, the ancient words leap off the page and touch a nerve in modern life. We get caught in dilemmas, often, between logic and the claims of compassion. How much can we help the cripples of life without encouraging a welfare state run wild? If we give refuge to a victim of war from some far-off country, do we diminish job opportunities for our fellow Americans and endanger our own future? If we have analytical minds, compassion is almost never simple. Charity, even when we can deduct it from our income tax, is probably more often than not an impulse of love and kindness. And these are not impulsive men. These are men who watch, calculating carefully just when to make a move. Smart men. So they keep their mouths shut and wait. Christ heals the man and sends him away and then takes the offensive for the second time. Which of you, if his donkey or his ox fell into a well, would not pull him out on the Sabbath? If one really kept the letter of the law, even that attempt to save an animal on the Sabbath would be illegal. But as Jesus knew from simple observation, most of the men around that table would do it in a minute. Property, after all, would be at stake. And when it comes to protecting our property, we can get very clever at bending the law. Once again, they can't answer, because he has sprung his own trap. If they confess to breaking the law to save a donkey, are they unwilling to do the same to save a human life? We can probably enjoy their predicament a little more if the thought does not occur to us that this keen critic, if he came to our house for dinner, would probably have us squirming too in about 5 minutes. They dug a pit for him. His wit pushed them into it. And perhaps he surrenders next to an understandable temptation to make them squirm just a little bit more. He had been watching them as they came into the banquet, how they competed with each other to get the choice places. So he tells them a story, asks them to watch something for a moment with his eyes. There is a party, he says, like the one they are attending. And into it there comes a pompous, blustery man whose appetite for the spotlight is even greater than his appetite for prime rib. Nodding to people right and left as he works his way to the front of the room, just settled in, beaming, when all of a sudden a guest of much greater importance arrives. The host comes up to our friend, puts his hand on his shoulder, and bends down to whisper something while everybody watches, wondering what's happening. And then the man gets up, his face red, and they know why. He's been asked to move. He has overreached himself, and everybody in that room loves his embarrassment. He looks for a seat close by, but they've all been filled by now, and he has to go all the way to the end of the table or the back of the room. It is the longest trip of his life. And then in that curious way parables have of ending before we're quite ready, Jesus finishes abruptly with this poor humiliated man and speaks one of the strange laws of his kingdom. In modern speech it would go like this: don't shove. Don't be pushy. If you do, sooner or later, you are going to be humiliated. Just do your work quietly and well, and in one way or another, your moment will come. The question is, does anybody believe it? Or is this just another one of those gospel sayings that we stuff into a decorated cookie can and open for a quick sniff on Sunday morning just so we won't forget entirely the quaint aroma Christianity once had? Isn't it much more fun to think that all our successes belong exclusively to us? And to wonder why other poor devils don't get up off their duffs and do the same? What is there, after all, if we've made it as a scholar or an author or a president, to make us humble? Isn't everybody in this society supposed to be climbing as fast and furiously as possible and insisting on our rights, even if they seem to be making a lot of other people miserable? And have you ever tried to imagine a whole country more concerned with its duties toward other nations than with its rights? Sounds insane, doesn't it? But in our present insanity, it might be wisdom. This little parable about the pathetic man with his ballooned-out ego is not just a lesson from Dear Abby or Miss Manners on how to behave socially. It's the word of Jesus that in the household of God, humility is a lovely and essential grace. And humility is possible only to those who take the time to remember certain things. That no one, for example, comes into the world debt-free. If you trace the ingredients of your success back to their source, you find certain gifts that came to you from someone else. moments of grace that were beyond your power to control. Do you have a high energy level that makes you work harder, want to work harder than almost anybody else and never get tired? Have you fooled yourself into thinking that this is only a matter of will? That anybody could work that hard if only he or she were willing? Well, look back to your genetic endowment somewhere and learn the truth. And how much have your looks helped? Good looks lubricate the machinery of success. Just ask the people who interview and promote. And unless you opted for cosmetic surgery, where did your good looks come from that have been so useful? But you say, at least I have a sense of pride. And a lot of people don't. And I know how much that has meant. But is pride a thing we can simply will to have? Or is it the end result of long years of faith in us by our families, of their insistence day after day that we do our best, of our learning how wonderful it is to be admired and respected? Some people cannot wait for reward. They have to have instant gratification or they give up. So where did you and I come to have faith that delay is not denial? That hard work will ultimately pay off. We had help. We may build on these gifts of other people to us, but so much of us is accidental that we have a world of reason to be humble, no matter how great our success. The kind of healthy humility Jesus hoped for us is not contrived. In fact, if you think too much about it, it becomes impossible. It's a kind of innocent way of simply forgetting to worry about compliments and prizes and seats of honor and the applause of fickle crowds. It's Albert Einstein walking into a room full of people and turning when they burst into applause to see who it is behind him that deserves such a tribute. It really happened. And it was totally unself-conscious. Or it is Mother Teresa holding a sick child in some hovel in India with a deeper happiness than she feels when the word comes that she has won the Nobel Prize. Or, much closer home to all of us in this room, it's simply the cheerful person who takes a genuine interest in what other people do and say, who seems to enjoy life without straining, who never talks about the credit she deserves for this prize or that one, and who never imagines for a single moment that all of this constitutes humility. I can't imagine anything better than being one of these people, or any higher ambition than wanting to be one of them. And I remind you this morning that it is the mission of this church to create such people.